All right, well, we're here for a very momentous occasion, the wrapping up of the Ornament of Precious Liberation. So within this, the framework of this class, this meeting time, which started out as the Key West Sangha, reached what year, like 2015, 2016. We have now completed three texts. We completed the Great Path of Awakening, and then we completed the 37 practices, and now we are officially completing the Ornament of Precious Liberation, our most ambitious undertaking to date. And we incorporated the Dying Every Day course into it. So that's four things we've completed. Although, you know, knock on wood, we didn't get to the end of the class yet today. So anything can happen, as we know, as Buddhists. All right. Well, if nobody has anything, then I'm going to mute everybody. And as always, you can unmute yourself as you need to or get my attention. And we will begin by first bringing our minds to rest. And so we will use Ringu Tulku's traditional instruction, bring your body to the seat. So get settled in our seat, check our posture and so forth. Spine straight, body relaxed. Bring your mind to your body. Like really feeling, you could do a body scan from top of the head to the toes and back again, or just feel the overall sensation of being in our body, our mind inhabiting our body. Just making sure we're in touch with how it feels to be in this body in this moment. And finally, bring ease to the mind. Just relax. Within the state of alertness, awareness, we should be utterly relaxed. So if we encounter any tension in our mind, we just let it go. We could scan our mind for any intent, any tension, anything we're caught up in right now, and just let it go. And now we'll do our prayers. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms according to the different propensities of beings. Please turn the wheel of Dharma, great lesser and uncommon. Tadan sem chantam chelo chisu drawers in gilap to soul, chalam du drawers in gilap to soul, am trupa sowers in gilap to soul, trupa yeshe suchawers in gilap to soul. I pray for blessing, may my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn towards the Dharma. I pray for blessing, may the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. Lai ke dang lu dan nujin ke chulum darami ke nam dang dro akunji draki jitsampar tam jke du da kitra tendo. In the tongues of nagas, yakshas, gods, those of humans and of demons too. In the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And the reminder for arousing bodhicitta, in case you have that one. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. And that is a summary of the Ornament of Precious Liberation. So we're going to do some meditation within our wrap up today, but we'll start with we're just going to zip through like very short, quick, classic Two Wings of Awakening meditation. So again, checking in with our posture, body to the seat, mind to the body, ease to the mind. Precious human existence, impermanence and death, karmic cause and result, the shortcomings of samsara. Imagining the Lama or the Buddha on the crown of our head in a body of light, requesting his or her blessing, receiving it just by requesting it. The Lama or the Buddha dissolves into light and merges with us and remains at our heart center, even when we're not aware of it. Focusing on our breath coming and going for a moment, just noticing each inhalation and exhalation and any pauses in between without losing the thread of it. Using just a small percentage of our attention with our awareness otherwise wide open. Very relaxed. Look at all experience as a dream. What if what we're experiencing right now is just a dream and we wake up from it? Letting the solidity of our experience recede. Now turning our attention to look at unborn awareness, the nature of our own mind. Can we say where it's located or whether it has a shape or color? Who is it that's looking at our experience as a dream? Just asking and resting. Letting even the remedy release naturally, letting go of even that level of conceptuality. Rest in the all basis, the essence of everything. As anything arises in our mind, we see the emptiness of it directly and just let it go. If our eyes are open, whatever sensory phenomena we may be perceiving, we let go of any thoughts about it, any grasping towards it. Just let it go. Just resting. And within this state of open awareness, We'll do taking and sending, bringing to mind someone we love, someone we feel compassion for, wishing for them to be free from suffering and breathing in their suffering as thick, dark smoke. Really taking it in, letting it dissolve along with our breath into the vastness of our Buddha nature. Breathing out to them, happiness, peace, awakening, whatever will make them happy. Adding to that visualization, someone we feel neutral towards, someone we don't know well, someone we encounter casually. Election canvassers. Breathing in their suffering, letting it dissolve, breathing out whatever they need. Optionally bringing to mind someone we are not on good terms with, someone who pushes our buttons. Adding them to the visualization and breathing their suffering in as well, wishing them also to be free from suffering. Wishing for them to have happiness, peace, and awakening, whatever kind of healing they need. And now expanding our scope to include all sentient beings in all six realms, humans, animals, hungry ghosts, hell beings, not gods and gods, breathing in their suffering, breathing out whatever they need. Just relaxing into this breathing meditation. Relaxing into the love and compassion we're cultivating for all sentient beings, including those we have difficulties with, including those we don't know. Remaining aware of all sensory impressions at the same time. Mind is very relaxed and spacious, even as we continue taking and sending. Eyes can be open or closed. Thinking that through this practice, we and all sentient beings are now filled with happiness, completely at peace, and completely awake. Rejoicing in that. And now letting go of the visualization and any conceptuality back to open awareness, following the breath if that's helpful. Just vast, open, and spacious. And filled with sensory perceptions and thoughts. Now letting go of even the intention to meditate. And ready to launch into our last class on Ornament of Precious Liberation. So does anybody have any questions or comments before we start? Okay. So we are now going to finish Ornament of Precious Liberation with Chapter 20, The Result of the Path, which is Perfect Buddhahood and the Activities of a Buddha, Chapter 21. I'm going to be almost exclusively referring to Ringu Tulku, the path of Buddhahood, path to Buddhahood. But first, how did we get here? It's been a year. And in the conclusion, Ringu Tulku says that's about what it should take to go through the book in some detail. I wanted to start out, I sent an email yesterday, I think, with the introduction, Gampopa's introduction to the book, like how we started, which we put a lot of emphasis on at the beginning. It's, you know, it's like setting up the whole like reason for embarking on this path in the first place and emphasizing the importance of doing this work. So I'm going to start by reading that. I'm going to read my translation. Whatever translation you're working with is fine. I'm just going to read through the introduction, which is short, just as a reminder of like what we've been doing on Thursdays for the past year. And we can sort of look back and see if we feel we understand this better, if it has any different meaning for us than it did a year ago. So, excuse me, still getting over a cold. So Gampopa introduces this set of teachings by saying, generally speaking, all phenomena can be categorized as either samsara or nirvana. So nothing in between. You're either in samsara or you're in nirvana. So what does that mean? How do you know which one you're in? With regard to samsara, its nature is emptiness. It manifests as confusion and it is characterized by suffering. So how it's characterized is how you know. If you have suffering in your life, you're in samsara. With regard to nirvana, its nature is also emptiness. They're both made of exactly the same thing. It manifests as the exhaustion and disappearance of all confusion. We might not know whether we're confused or not. What we know is the defining characteristic, and the defining characteristic of nirvana is freedom from all suffering. So you win the grand prize. If you don't have any suffering in your life at all, you've already reached nirvana. The path has done its job and we're done. And we'll learn more about that today. That's the topic of today, is what do you do when you're done? So he set like the groundwork here, like, okay, we're either in samsara or nirvana and we know which one we're in. And if we're in samsara, that's the problem. That's why we need the path. So then he's going to elucidate a little bit more about samsara. Who is confused in samsara? Who are these people who are confused? All sentient beings of the three realms. And that's the three realms, the desire realm, the form and the formless realms. All of the six realms that we talk about are within the desire realm. The form and the formless realms are realms you get to through certain kinds of meditation. What is the basis of confusion? Confusion is projected onto emptiness. What is the cause of confusion? Fundamental ignorance. And we've learned that that basically means a dualistic perspective, like, you know, really taking subject and object as the way things are, seeing everything outside us as solid and, you know, permanent in some sense. That's fundamental ignorance. How does confusion manifest as the realms or experience of the six types of beings? And that, I found that interesting in light of Pema Chidren's teaching on the realms as psychological states. So confusion manifests as the six realms. It manifests as the anger of the hell realms. It manifests as the neediness of the hungry ghost realm, as the confusion of the animal realm, as the... what's the human realm, the sort of the, how did she put it? The, like the what if of the human realm, like just you're so close to, you have such a taste of pleasure that you now want everything to be pleasure and you want to get rid of suffering. And then the in the gods realms, the competitiveness of the not God's realms and the bliss, the sort of fatal bliss of the God's realms. That's how confusion manifests. Is there a metaphor to describe confusion? It is like sleep and dreams. And if we learned a lot about that in Dying Every Day and Mingyur Rinpoche's book. When did confusion begin? There has been confusion since beginningless time. There's no beginning to confusion. What's the problem with being confused? That all experience is suffering. When will confusion transform into wisdom? Not until unsurpassable awakening is attained. So that's our first hint that there's a way out of this. We're not stuck with the confusion. Just because we're in samsara now and we experience suffering doesn't mean that's the way it has to be. It will transform into wisdom when we wake up. Samsara will transform into nirvana when we wake up. For anyone who thinks confusion may clear up by itself, samsara is well known to be endless. So that's the bad news. You got the good news that we can wake up, and the bad news, it won't happen unless we make it happen. It's going to take work on our part. So in light of the reality, and this is the zinger, in light of the reality that samsara is nothing but confusion, the intensity and duration of the suffering it involves, and that it will never liberate itself, from this day forward, from this moment forward, we must make every effort to attain unsurpassable awakening. So that's why we need the path. That's why we need the ornament of precious liberation. So what does this effort require? How do we go about this thing? He says, those with discernment will come to know unsurpassable awakening through these six topics: cause, support, condition, method, result, and activity. And so here's the outline of the book that he gives us at the very beginning of the book, and that we have gone through in detail, each of these six topics. The cause is Buddha nature. We all have that. The support is the most precious human existence. We have that under certain conditions. We're all lucky enough to have that. So we have a basis for waking up. The condition is the authentic teacher. We all have a connection with an authentic teacher. So those are the three prerequisites. We got them all. They're all checked off. So we can wake up. We have all the conditions we need to wake up. The method is the teacher's instruction. The fourth topic is the teacher's instruction. That's most of the book. The results, which we're doing today, the results are the bodies, also known as the kayas, or the dimensions of perfect Buddhahood, and the activity of a Buddha is the non-conceptual accomplishment of the benefit of being. So we've been through most of this journey. We're going to wrap it up today with the last two topics. So let's see. So I just wanted to also review the four obstacles to awakening, because those are still very much living factors in our lives. We're still working to wake up, and we're still derailed by the four obstacles from time to time. So anybody remember? Does everybody remember what the four obstacles are? Because this would be a really good thing to always have in your mind. First one is being too busy, being too attached to the activities of this life. No time to wake up. Second one is when we're not too busy, too attracted to pleasures and distractions. Third one is being too attached to our own personal peace. That's sort of being stuck in like Shine meditation, like wanting to just have a peaceful mind and not engage with the messiness of the world and the messiness of other sentient beings. I certainly feel that one sometimes. And then the fourth one is not knowing how to do it. And that's what the book is about. So there's antidotes to the four obstacles. And these are also, you should know, if you know the obstacle, you should know the antidote. So what's the antidote to being too busy, being too caught up in the activities of this world? And I know Marilyn is saying them out loud right now. Impermanence is the antidote to being too busy. And the antidote to being too caught up in the pleasures and distractions of worldly life are two: karma, like what you do in this life is going to lead somewhere, is what you're engaging in leading you where you want to go. And then the suffering of samsara, and that's the fourth thought. It's like, don't think that just getting a better samsaric situation is going to help you, because it's not. So that discourages us from just working in worldly ways to get a better job, have more money, have a better house, have, better quality of entertainment. Maybe I need a different Roku channel. An additional Roku channel would help me have more to, engage with. So that's the first two obstacles taken away. So when you feel yourself, the point of these antidotes and knowing the obstacles is that when you see yourself falling into one of them, too busy, too busy, too busy, then you think about impermanence. Oh, right. As Dr. Wong said, the work will still be there when you die. Do you want to die without having woken up? And then when you feel yourself too distracted, to remember karma. Remember, like, it's what I'm doing right now that's going to determine what happens to me next. And remember, oh, samsara, like, even the best parts of it are still suffering. So then the antidote to antidotes to being too attached to personal peace are love and compassion. And so these are all chapters in the book, as we recall. And then the antidote to not knowing how to do it is the whole rest of the book, up to chapter 20, really through the six paramitas. But the, you know, the pads and the bhumis, which we went over last time, that's an overview of the same thing. It's how, the how-to of it. So the path of awakening, so after he's given us, after Gompopa has laid out these obstacles and their antidotes, and we've gone through them basically, and we're up to not knowing how to do it, the answer to that is the whole path. And so then he takes us through the path step by step, chapter by chapter, and it starts with refuge, taking the Buddha as your example, the Dharma as your method, and the Sangha as your support, taking the Bodhisattva vow, which is what we do at the beginning of every class. I'm going to wake up so that I can help all other beings wake up, and I'm going to do it through study, contemplation, and meditation. and so the Bodhisattva vow, that's like really aspiration bodhicitta, and then action bodhicitta, which boils down to the six paramitas. So that's your review of the whole path. And if any part of that is not like really at the top of your brain, it's good to keep studying it. Like just that framework, to be able to know that framework as you go through your daily life is, I can tell you, so helpful. So if you don't already, I would just go over that material again and again. Know the four obstacles, know the three prerequisites so that you can appreciate that you have this precious opportunity. Know the four obstacles so you know where the pitfalls are. Know the antidotes so that you can bring yourself out of those pitfalls, and know the path and practice the path. Remember refuge, remember your Bodhisattva vow, and practice the six paramitas. John, I'm going to unmute you. Or you're going to unmute yourself.
Yeah, I had a question.
Sure.
Laziness, is that not an obstacle, or is it a subcategory? Is it part of a different list? I thought it would have been an obstacle, but I'm confused.
It's an obstacle. It's not one of the four obstacles to awakening here, but it actually is explained in the fourth paramita, perseverance, joyful perseverance. And remember the three kinds of laziness. First kind of laziness is being lazy, like just not doing the work. That's definitely an obstacle. I'd say that one, like if you were going to equate that with any of the four like primary obstacles, it would probably fall into the second one, the distractibility. You know, why are you not doing the work? Because you don't feel like it. That's a distraction in itself. You feel like doing something else. Second kind of laziness is feeling like you can't do it. Everybody else has a Buddha nature. Everybody else, those other people can do it, but I'm not worthy. I can't do it. I'm not good enough. And then the third kind of laziness. Uh-oh, what is the third kind? Anybody remember? Marilyn, I'm going to unmute you.
I have to confess I have my own cheat sheets here.
Okay, we'll use the cheat sheet because it's gone out of my mind.
Distraction. I have as the third one, distraction. Inertia, okay. Discouragement, and distraction. That's what I've got.
Okay. We'll go with that. We can all look it up. We can all look it up after. Anyway, John, that's probably the best answer I can give. I don't know if anybody else has anything else to say on that.
Oh, that's great, because I just forgot where exactly it fit in. So
yeah.
You reminded me. Thank
you. You knew it was in there somewhere.
Thank you.
Okay, sure. Thanks for the question. Anybody else? All right. Well, the good news is we have completed the review. And now we are on to Well, actually, we haven't completed the review. There's the five paths and the 10 boomies. The five paths, let's see if I can remember them because I did not write them down. There's the path of accumulation, which is where we spend most of our time, probably just learning all the practices and so forth, learning the methods of meditation, perfecting those. Then the path of, I forget, path of integration or joining or juncture, which is like this short bridge where it sort of all comes together, which results in the third path, the path of seeing, where you directly experience emptiness for the first time. And that is that's where the boomies begin. That's the first boomy. The fourth one is meditation, which is not a really good translation here particularly. It's really cultivation, familiarity. It's like you've seen emptiness and now you've got to stabilize that through your practice. So you just keep at it. You keep being alert for more glimpses of it. You keep reinforcing, you know, your perception of things as empty. And then the fifth one is called no more learning, which is Buddhahood, basically. So all the 10 boomies happen. The first boomy happens in the third path, and then all the other 9 boomies are within the fourth path, the path of meditation or familiarization, or the path of doing the work, the path of practice. Practice would be actually a good translation there, I think. And then the 10 boomies, the main, like the real sort of mnemonic I have for the 10 boomies, like what distinguishes them, because it's really, that is the path of practice, the path of familiarization, the path of purification. You're just refining your realization, like step by step. And so each one is associated with the perfection of a particular paramita of the 10. Now there's 10 paramitas. And so the first 6 boomies are the first 6 paramitas that we know. And then there's the other 4 paramitas, which I can't say off the top of my head, skillful means and yeshe, the other kind of wisdom. And then there's a couple of more in there. So that's the overview of the path. And this is all really, really helpful material. I cannot overemphasize. And so I encourage you, you know, at intervals in your life, keep going back to, if you don't want to go back to the full Ornament of Precious Liberation, and I understand that, reread The Path to Buddhahood or reread parts of it, you know, keep it by your bedside. And, you know, when you don't have something else to do, you don't have more enticing literature, you're between murder mysteries, read a chapter of Ringu Tulku. Between TV shows like Game of Thrones is gone and nothing has appeared in its place, read Ringu Tulku until the next thing comes. And it will deepen your understanding. I mean, I've taught it like 3 times now, and I feel like every time it's like, oh, I really needed to read this again. But also every time it's like, right, I remember this. It's, you know, it makes more sense, and so forth. So anyway. Any questions before we now go into the new material?
Can I?
Yes, Mark, please.
Yeah. So I was listening to Trungpa talking about the boomies.
Yeah.
He was saying you shouldn't take it like it's a, you have to do 1 and then you do 2 and then you do 3 and then you do, you know, that it's more like you just compare yourself to the 10 and you go through them and you look at yourself. Compare yourself, your mind, to where the boomies are pointing to, and then that's really what it's about. That's what he's
saying. Not a linear process, in short.
Right.
Yeah. And actually, Gampopa makes a very similar observation in the Ornament of Precious Liberation, that the order that they're in and the boomies is actually the natural order in which they tend to be perfected, tend to unfold. That, like, generosity leads to ethics, leads to patience and so forth, but they all happen, we're all cultivating all of them simultaneously.
Yeah.
Really. And for any individual, maybe we get patience first, who knows, and we still can't give away like a precious belonging. But thank you. It's always good to hear Trungpa Rinpoche's take on things. Anybody else got anything from some enlightened teacher to share with us before we go on? All right. Anybody need to stretch? Anybody feeling sleepy? Like, you know, the weather is kind of like overcast today. It's like good sleeping weather where I am. All right. Well, but now the good news is we're going to experience Buddhahood now. Which mostly consists, like the chapter on the results mostly consists of Ringo Tuchel reinforcing, like, what we need to do to actually become Buddha, to actually fully realize our Buddha nature. But he does it really elegantly. It's a very lovely chapter. They're all lovely chapters, but this one's also really lovely. And I made myself notes, and I'm going to read passages. So let me find the chapter. Right. All right, so in Ringu Tulku, I am on page 149, which is not a page with a page number on it. I really hate that. I write them in pencil, so I'm not always having to flip to the next page. So Ringu Tulku begins, right. So he's going to talk about what it takes to attain Buddhahood in one lifetime. And so he says on page 149, I'm starting in the mid paragraph, the Bodhisattva Bhumi, that's a text, states, these levels, like all the levels, which are nonlinear, as Mark says, the levels are accomplished over the span of three. Well, yeah, let's see. I'll just start at the beginning of the paragraph. Discussing this subject is the subject of Buddhahood. Is even more difficult than presenting the phases that lead to it. Indeed, none of us knows what Buddhahood is really like, and after reading the last chapter, it can seem a long way off. After reading the five paths and the 10 bhumis, it's like, that's going to take forever. So he says, the Bodhisattva Bhumi states, these levels are accomplished over the span of three countless cosmic eons. Sometimes one lifetime can feel like that. Well, gosh, that would be a long time. However, says Ringu Tulku, the phases we've just covered don't necessarily take a long time. What matters is not the time, but the approach we take. The main point is to be able to get a direct realization of our true nature and then get rid of our habitual patterns. So that's like the seeing directly the nature of things and then the familiarization or the practice that stabilizes that realization. So we want to get a direct realization of our true nature and then get rid of our habitual patterns. That's the work of the Bhumis. Working on these habitual tendencies takes a very long time if we approach the path according to the usual Sutrayana way. However, the unique Vajrayana path, and that is the advantage of the Vajrayana path, it's the fast track to Buddhahood. The unique Vajrayana path enables us to attain Buddhahood in a single lifetime as long as we have the right conditions, the right mental attitude, the right understanding, and a qualified mentor who can transmit the strong, direct teachings that introduce us to the nature of mind. And, this is the big and provided that we work one-pointedly on this path. We could say that really fast, and it doesn't sound too bad. But what does that mean, that we work one-pointedly on this path? Like, are we doing that? I don't think that's what I'm doing. I aspire to that. And I feel like I do a fair amount of practice, but I do forget sometimes and I do spend time in distraction and so forth. So I may not do it in one lifetime, but still probably maybe better than three countless cosmic eons. I'm hoping for better than that with the Vajrayana methods perhaps applied a little bit lazily. Well, so that's the formula for actually getting there in one lifetime. And he gives the example of Milarepa as evidence that it can be done. It is possible to get enlightened in this very life, and it has been proven. The best example of such an achievement is Milarepa. Some of his disciples were persuaded that his level of accomplishment was such that he must be the reincarnation of a very great being. Milarepa replied that although they meant to be very respectful, even flattering, they were in fact belittling and underestimating the power of the Dharma. He said, "You seem to be saying that one achieves nothing simply through practicing the Dharma and that to get results one must have been a very great person in past lives. However, I was nothing in particular in my previous life. What I am and what I have achieved is purely the fruit of my practice in this life." So that should inspire us to practice as one-pointedly as possible. The prospect of like having the realization of Milarepa and Gampopa and all of the, you know, all of the realized masters. All right, so that's how we do it. That's how, what it takes to become a Buddha. So we didn't get to Buddhahood yet. So then on page 150, what is a Buddha? So he says, first, the nature of Buddhahood. A truly perfect Buddha is the best possible purity and the best possible primordial wisdom. And that is Yeshe or Jhana. A Buddha has pure, and this is the definition, a Buddha has purified everything that needed to be purified and has awakened all the wisdom that needed to be awakened. And this is reflected in the two syllables in Tibetan song, Jay. Song is purified, everything that needs to be purified, and Jay is blossomed or awakened, everything that needs to be awakened. So that's the definition of a Buddha. So that's what we're working towards, purification and accumulation of wisdom. Okay. Ah. There we go. Okay, so let's see. So all beings, human and non-human, have the potential hidden beneath their confusion and ignorance. Yeah, that's a little further on. Okay, so we can all do it, in short. This is the work that needs to be done. We can all do it. We all have the potential to do it. So I have a note here. The different phases on the Bodhisattva path correspond to the levels of purification and the simultaneous awakening of wisdom. Oh, yeah, that's okay. That's at the bottom of the page. So that's So the phases, the stages of the path and the Bodhisattva bhumis are all, they're just different stages of refinement of both purification and wisdom, this gradual process of perfecting both aspects. So we're on to page 151. Okay. So we're going to define what the mind of a Buddha is like. So we're starting now to get into what Buddhahood is. We've sort of talked about how to get to it. Now, what is it? So in the first full paragraph here, halfway through, in fact, all the Buddhist philosophers agree that the essential characteristic of a Buddha's mind is its non-conceptual, non-dualistic quality. So that's what the Paramita of Wisdom was about. What is the nature of mind like? Non-conceptual, non-dualistic. Buddhists have totally eliminated conceptuality, that's the purification aspect, and have transcended the dualistic approach, that's the wisdom aspect, that distinguishes between me and other. Skipping down, it's not a blank state of mind, but it is a completely clear state of mind. So Buddhahood doesn't mean everything stops and you're just in the Dharmakaya. It's everything is still going on. You've still got all the aspects, all the appearances, but you just see them with perfect clarity. Non-conceptual, at the bottom of that paragraph, non-conceptual means leaving things as they are without adding or removing anything. Non-duality has almost the same meaning. To say this is my thought or this is disturbing me reflects a dualistic approach. So anytime I, me, and mine enter into the equation, you know that you're in a dualistic frame of mind. So we're going to skip ahead, page 152. More on Buddha mind. So a Buddha feels, sees, and understands with much more clarity than we do. So that's the difference between samsara and nirvana. Nirvana here in Gampopa, in his introduction, being the state of completely pure, perfect Buddhahood. A Buddha feels, sees, and understands with much more clarity than we do. Our perception of things is constantly confused because of the various concepts that we attach to them. So we don't see things clearly because we are caught up. Everything is seen through the overlay and the filters of our opinions, our preconceptions, like what experience did we have with that thing before? We assume we're going to have the same experience with it now. Our judgments, all of that stuff gets in the way of our seeing things clearly. And those are the things that we are purifying on the bhumis. As a Buddha's mind has no duality, he or she has no feeling of separateness. Hence, There isn't any feeling of aversion or attachment to anything. A Buddha remains in a state of perfect equanimity. His or her mind is sharp and distinctive. They chase nothing nor run away from anything. This is what we call wisdom. So non-duality. Oh yeah, Marilyn, I'm gonna unmute you.
I've been wondering whether, it sounds pretty weird, but whether equanimity and bliss are the same thing. They certainly aren't the way we use the word bliss, but every time I've tried to figure out what bliss is meant in the Dharmic context, I think it means equanimity, which sounds crazy. So can you enlighten me on that?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say I'm an expert on it, but what I've heard said, I don't think they're exactly the same thing, but I think they're very interrelated. That if you want to give a characteristic to bliss, I know Yeshe Jomtso has talked about this, and he's a very well-studied person. He says that really when they talk about bliss, they're talking about like a sense of well-being, a very deep, even, unshakable sense of well-being. And so there would be an equanimity factor to that in that it's even, but equanimity just means really evenness, you know, not preferring one thing over another. I mean, the equanimity here would be no attachment, no aversion, I think. And the bliss would be being completely at peace with that. So that's my take on it. I don't know, Lama Jinzang, if you have anything to say about that or if anybody else has any thoughts on that. Okay, Lama Jinzang, you're unmuted.
I think you hit it on the head that this concept of it being a total sense of well-being such that you're not affected by anything as being, I mean, it's being good or bad. You're beyond that completely.
You could have pain and be in that state. And Mingyur Rinpoche talks about that really, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you. Did you have more to say on that?
No, you can go. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that Mingyur Rinpoche is a beautiful description of that. And the very beginning of like the first chapter or two of Joy of Living, his first book. Where he talks about overcoming his panic attacks through intensive meditation and his 3-year retreat when he was so overwhelmed that he was going to have to leave if he didn't solve it. And he just has this beauty. I don't have the book anymore. I gave my book away and I don't think I've replaced it. But he talks about that, the unshakability of this feeling of peace and well-being even in unpleasant circumstances, like no matter what comes at you. And we see him, you know, in a sense in his book, dealing with like terrible circumstances or very difficult circumstances and challenges that do shake him up at the beginning. And he realizes he didn't, like he's still got work to do. But by the end, it's like in love with the world. I think that's the bliss, you know, in love with the world. It's like nothing shakes that. It doesn't matter if he gets sick or if he encounters, you know, smelly train stations or difficult people or no money or whatever. But he has this sense of this evenness of well-being to his experience, no matter what else is going on. So anything further on that, Marilyn? Did you, okay.
I have one.
Yes, Mark.
Which is complete disappearance of the difference between subject and object produces, is associated with bliss, let's say it that way.
Okay. Thank you. I think, Ringu Tulku said something, he wasn't talking about bliss, but he said something about that in talking about non-dualistic mind of a Buddha before, that like the distinction between self and other disappears. And so, yeah, I think that would be, that you're in the nature of mind then. And that is part of like the definition of the nature of mind, is that it has these qualities, you know, love, compassion, equanimity, well-being or bliss, peace, and so forth, no matter what. So nothing has to go away. Outer circumstances don't have to go away or be improved in any way. It's a completely internal phenomenon. Anything further, Mark?
No, not really. I mean, that if you are making differences with your mind, then you're causing yourself unnecessary confusion and suffering.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. But it's,
don't do it.
I mean, often that's not a conscious process, and that's, you know, it's not a choice that we can make.
Right.
You know, I mean, I was just corresponding with somebody at some, you know, we had a bit of back and forth. He decided that the way to solve this whole thing is just to stop using the pronoun I, and he started referring to himself as it. And I'm like, it's just another label for the same thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any difference. And he didn't get it. And he said, well, there's this commune in Virginia where they use some other word, like, I forget, com or something like that to refer to everybody. It's not they. No, it's like they invented a word.
Yeah.
It's Twin Oaks Commune in Virginia. It's been here for decades. And I'm like, no, it doesn't matter what you call it.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter. You can't just make the choice. I'm not going to be dualistic anymore. I'm not going to distinguish between I and other anymore, because it's not a conceptual thing. You know, it's not a thing we do conceptually. It's just something that we reflexively do. And so that's the work of the Bhumis, is to eradicate that, like, sort of step by step, not that it's necessarily linear, but just to gradually refine that so that through practice it disappears.
Yeah.
You get a glimpse of it when you see emptiness, because that is what that experience is. It's non-duality. But to stabilize that in your everyday experience, that is the work of, how does he put it? One-pointed work over a period of time.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Mark. Anybody else before we go on? All right. So we're almost actually to the end of this time. We're going to leave a little time at the end to talk about Ringu Tulku. Those of us who saw him, it's too bad Kathy is not here, but Dave's here to represent Kathy. Oh, so somebody had something to say?
Joanne.
Oh, Joanne. Yeah, go ahead. Hi, right. Joanne.
Hi, Lama. I think what Mark was alluding to brought to mind ultimate bodhicitta, the practices 22, 23, and 24.
In the 37 practices?
Practices, mm-hmm. Yes, that just kind of really keyed in and helped me achieve a better understanding.
Do you want to read those verses to us?
Oh.
Do you have them in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
The highlighted ones, like the very brief ones, or in full text?
No, you can read the full. It's just three verses. We can take the time. That's a good reminder.
To remain free from subject-object fixation. All appearances are my own mind. Mind's nature from the start is concept-free. To know my own mind's nature and refrain from grasping onto subject-object signs. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. And 23, to give up attachment to positive experiences. When I encounter something that's delightful, such as a rainbow on a summer day, to give up all attachment to its beauty and never cling to it as truly real. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. And 24, and this is one I'm working on, to regard adverse circumstances as delusion. All forms of suffering are just like dreaming. That my beloved child has passed away. Appearances are like these are just delusions. To take them as true drains my energy. When I encounter adverse circumstances, to see them as delusions of my mind. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So that one, that's, I really got to work on.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're all working on that.
Can I say one thing on that one too?
Sure, go ahead, Mark.
The teacher that I had, he said, when you get to that, it may seem really selfish. Like you're saying, well, all that stuff, you know, doesn't matter, and I'm just going to pay attention to my own bliss or something. But really, if you're thinking about being connected to all sentient beings and helping them out of the same type of situation, then it really is not selfish.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're getting there into the ultimate versus relative, because like ultimate realization, the realization of emptiness is like a personal thing. Like that's something you do. That's actually called the self-benefit, is realizing the Dharmakaya, the emptiness, and then applying it to others out of love and compassion. That's getting into the relative aspect, relative bodhicitta. So yeah, we have to do that work. It's not selfish. and it can be, it can feel that way, and it can be expressed that way. Thank you, Joanne.
You're welcome, Lama.
I always love it when we, you know, integrate the texts. All right, so we'll go on and finish up what it's like to be a Buddha. Okay, so we read 152, how to realize Buddha nature. It won't happen intellectually. Oh, right, he went through some stuff here. I didn't want to read the whole passage, but he basically makes the point that the realization of our Buddha nature will not happen as an intellect, will not figure it out conceptually. It has to be come down to direct experience. And so that's why our meditation practice is so important. We have study. It's very important to know what the view is, like what reality is said to look like to a Buddha, so that it will help us recognize it when we do see it. So we have to study it and contemplate it, but we have to do the work ourselves of sitting and actually gaining direct experience through meditation. Let's see, 152. Nope. All right. And then he talks about the six methods of Tilopa. I don't know if everybody remembers that, the six points of Tilopa. That's a meditation that's in the Wisdom Paramita chapter. The way that can, this, and this is how we do the work of arriving at Buddha nature, of gaining direct experience of the nature of mind, of transcending dualistic perception. So Tilopa's six points are an instruction in how to do that. And you could meditate just with that. Also working on love and compassion, because we have, you know, we are also still doing taking and sending and helping others in any way that we can, as described in the Ethics Paramita. But to get to the realization of nature of mind ourselves, six points of Tilopa are a map for that. And so in Ken Holmes's translation, that is, we could just take a moment. That's not the meditation we're going to do, but let's just take a moment and do Tilopa's six instructions. So back to body to the seat, mind to the body, ease to the mind. Let go of what has passed. So any thoughts of the past. Let go of what may come. Any thoughts of the future. Let go of what is happening now. Any thoughts of the present. And again, just like Mark said, quoted Trungpa as saying about the Bodhisattva movies, this is not linear. Like, this is a linear instruction, but it's not like, okay, past gone, future gone, present gone, and then the other instructions. Things are going to keep coming back up as you sit. And so those are just the guideline. Whenever a thought of the past comes up, let go of what is past. Whenever a thought of the future comes up, let go of what may come. Whenever a thought of the present moment comes up, let go of what is happening now. And then getting a little more technical into like the meditation itself, the nature of the meditation itself, let go of trying to figure anything out. Sometimes translated as let go of meditation. Even trying to meditate, we let go of that, looking for a particular state of mind. And let go of trying to make anything happen. Let go of controlling your experience. Let go of judging or evaluating, like, is this it? Is this not it? Am I doing it right? Let go of all that. So those are all the things to let go of. And then the instruction for what to actually do is relax right now and rest. So within relax right now and rest, which is the main instruction here, we just gently monitor our awareness. And when a thought of the past comes up, we let go, et cetera, et cetera. When a thought of, am I doing it right, comes up, we let it go. When a thought of, you know, I need to, you know, am I in the right meditative state? Do I need to adjust my meditative state? Let that go too. Just let go of anything, any conceptuality at all that arises, and relax right now and rest. So that is the very brief, you know, meditation on like how to actually cultivate Buddha mind. So now we're going to skip over some things as we come to the end of the chapter, because I wanted to look at the three kayas again. That's the next thing. That is the definition of Buddha, is complete realization of the three kayas, the three bodies of a Buddha, the three dimensions of Buddhahood, the three aspects of Buddhahood, the three ways that Buddha can manifest. We all love the three kayas, and we all, you know, work towards understanding them and embodying them more. So we're going to read, we're just going to read some bits here. So on page 154, bottom of the first section, as Milarepa indicates in the text quoted above, which the text quoted above is where he's quoting the Buddha. Somebody asked the Buddha to explain. And he said, let's see, do I have this written down anywhere? The Buddha said, do not think there is any one-sided reply to this. Dharmakaya is, they asked him to explain Dharmakaya. Dharmakaya is beyond the grasp of the intellect. It is unborn and free of conceptual complication. Do not ask me, look into the mind. That is the way it is. So again, reinforcing that, it's not something that can be communicated in words or conceptually. We have to do the work. So as Milarepa indicates, we can discover the three kayas within ourselves by looking directly at the nature of mind. How do we look directly at the nature of mind? Follow Tilopa's instructions or any other instructions that you have from your teachers, any other instructions that are in the Wisdom Paramita. So under Dharmakaya, we're just going to read a little bit. If we see without obscuration the Dharmakaya within ourselves, we achieve enlightenment and are perfectly purified and liberated. The experiences, the realizations, the state of an arhat, and the phases of bodhisattva path are just a matter of seeing the Dharmakaya more and more clearly. So all those five paths and 10 bhumis is refinement of our direct connection with the Dharmakaya aspect of our own mind. When we've completely realized it without any obstruction, we've become Buddhas. So Buddhahood is the full realization of the Dharmakaya aspect of our own mind. But what is it? The Dharmakaya is not something. Gampopa defines it as follows. The term Dharmakaya simply means the exhaustion of all error, the disappearance of what is of a delusional nature. Once the meaning of voidness, the Dharma Dhatu, has been realized. Dharmakaya is only a word that means that all confusions, delusions, and obscurations have disappeared. That's all. However, we're going to go back to page 72, where the first time he talks about the three kayas, because I think it's really easy to understand here. So on page 72, the Dharmakaya is bottom of the page. The Dharmakaya is the Buddha's mind. It is completely free from any delusion. So it is free from concepts, assumptions, grasping, doubts, and fear. It is limitless, boundless, clear, and direct awareness. Top of page 73. This is the deepest experience of the true nature of our mind, the Dharmakaya. This experience is also called Rigpa, Mahamudra, clear light, and great perfection, Dzogchen. Like space, it is limitless, uncompounded, unable to be grasped, unable to be identified in any way. It is always there, but you cannot capture it. It is peaceful. Nothing can disturb it. It is clear. Everything is seen unobstructedly. It is compassionate. All beings are seen as equal to oneself. So even compassion exists within the Dharmakaya. It's a quality of the Dharmakaya. It is powerful. A Dharmakaya being can emanate and arise as anything or anybody as is needed with no effort. This is the essential nature of all our minds. So that's the Dharmakaya. You're not going to get it from going over it briefly here in class together. Read and reread this section on the Dharmakayas, and you will come to understand more and more what they are. So now back to page 156 to the 157 to the Sambhogakaya, 158 actually, because we're skipping over most of it. 158. The Sambhogakaya is the manifestation of the clarity that is part of the Dharmakaya. So nothing is going to be separate from the Dharmakaya. It's the manifestation of clarity within the Dharmakaya. When one has a complete understanding, a complete realization of the Dharmakaya, from one's point of view, there's nothing that isn't pure and enjoyable. This is sort of talking about bliss here. Everything becomes enjoyable. Everything becomes pleasant when you have a complete understanding and realization of the Dharmakaya. And so that's the enjoyment of it, is the Sambhogakaya aspect. When Sambhogakaya forms are represented, they're always youthful and very beautiful. That's Chenrezig, Tara, and so forth. Adorned with jewels and ornaments, they express complete enjoyment and represent the pure vision of a Buddha. Everything is seen from this point of view when we perceive our true nature, the Dharmakaya. Nothing is impure, and we see all beings as perfect, also called sacred outlook. A Buddha perceives other beings as pure while realizing that they don't see themselves as such. So back to page 73, the earlier explanation of the Dharmakaya, a little more elementary. If the Dharmakaya, middle of the page, if the Dharmakaya, this beautiful line, the first one under Sambhogakaya, Sambhogakaya is the way Buddhas see themselves, as the radiance of the five wisdoms, ever pure, as it can never be defiled, ever youthful as it is beyond birth, death, and change. The literary translation of Sambhogakaya is body of enjoyment. If the Dharmakaya is the complete and total realization of what we call Buddha mind in its original pure state, free of all duality and negative emotion, that was the Dharmakaya, then the Sambhogakaya is the presence of different aspects of wisdom. Buddha nature is not a dull state comparable to deep sleep. On the contrary, it is alive with vibrant and powerful energies, what we call the five wisdoms. To explain it very briefly, the five negative emotions can be transformed into the five corresponding wisdoms. Buddha nature, far from being an empty void or just clear awareness, also possesses these energies, these wisdoms. This is why the Sambhogakaya forms of the Buddhas are always represented in Tibetan religious art as young and beautiful princes or princesses adorned with jewels and magnificent ornaments, symbolizing the vivacity, the shining radiance of this aspect of Buddhahood. So when you have the sacred outlook that is born of seeing emptiness, of seeing the Dharmakaya directly, that's how you see everything. That's how you see your fellow beings, even though, as the earlier passage said, they don't see themselves that way. So now we're going to go on to the Nirmanakaya, and that is on page 158, back to that section. The Nirmanakaya is the form through which beings perceive a Buddha. We cannot see Sambhogakaya in our unrealized state, but we can see Nirmanakaya. So that's how beings perceive a Buddha whose only aim is to help them. This form, the Nirmanakaya form, can manifest through any aspect as a man, a woman, an animal, a god, music, a bridge, food for the hungry, medicine for the sick, and so on. Anything that can be useful to beings. And each of these kayas in this part of the book has like eight characteristics. We're not reading them now, but I wanted to read the first two for Nirmanakaya. Its basis is the Dharmakaya from which it emanates without there being any shift. So you don't go from the Dharmakaya to the Nirmanakaya. It's like the Nirmanakaya is imbued with Dharmakaya. And that's in a lot of the sadhanas, like that the Buddha manifests without ever being separate from the Dharmakaya. And then number two, it arises from tremendous compassion, which aspires to benefit every single being. So Nirmanakaya forms manifest from the Dharmakaya only to benefit sentient beings. So then back to page 73, the Nirmanakaya. So the third aspect is the Nirmanakaya. Nirmanakaya is what is seen by others. When one becomes a Buddha, one doesn't disappear from this world like a blown out candle flame. Like you don't just go to the Dharmakaya and reside there. You're still manifesting in all three ways. They're all simultaneous. They're all completely interconnected. They're just different aspects, different ways of that a Buddha manifests. the flow, the continuity of the Buddha emanations remains and never stops. Just as we experience this life and a succession of rebirths within samsara, when one becomes completely enlightened, Buddha mind continues to manifest in all the forms that are necessary and useful for the benefit of beings. A Buddha no longer has any limited or egotistical thoughts. He or she can manifest innumerable emanations without being restricted by space, time, variety, or number. These manifestations are what we call the Nirmanakaya. And I wanted to end the discussion of the kayas with this next paragraph on page 74. This is like Ringu Tulku's summary. The three kayas are one way of describing and understanding the qualities of a Buddha. All three aspects are present at the same time. A Buddha's mind is absolutely clear and aware and therefore does not need to make any assumptions and concepts because all is perceived directly. You don't have to have concepts about things if you see clearly exactly the way they are. You don't need Google. It sees the enlightened as well as the unenlightened aspects and can manifest in whatever way might help beings. The three kayas are also the inherent nature of our own mind. When we realize them experientially, that is enlightenment. And I want to take just a moment. We only have like a little over 10 minutes left, and the next chapter we do very quickly. But I just wanted to read this passage from Trungpa Rinpoche's Training the Mind. This is in the slogan on emptiness, on the three kayas, which he translates a little differently than other translations. In my little book, it's page 96. The page number will vary in the full-size book, but it's slogan 14. Seeing confusion as the four kayas is unsurpassable shunyata, or emptiness protection. So what he says, I'm just going to read a paragraph, but like the whole passage is really fabulous, but because of time, I'll just read the very beginning. It's how to see the three kayas in our own daily moment-to-moment experience. And you could start to look at this and start to see how the three kayas work in your own not fully realized mind and how that can develop into full realization of the three kayas. So he says, and it's the second paragraph in this section, in perception, like whatever we perceive, whatever experience we are entering into in our life, in perception, first there will be a sense of waiting or openness. I guess what Mingyur Rinpoche calls the gap, like between experiences or between states of mind. So first there may be uncertainty as to how to perceive things, not knowing how to make a particular situation graspable. So something happens at the beginning, it's not solid, like we don't quite know what's going on. That would seem to be the Dharmakaya. He's not giving them names in this particular paragraph. But no characteristics, no definable characteristics. That's like the Dharmakaya. Then we have a clear idea of how to organize things. So for going from not solid, it solidifies into this is what's going on, this is what I'm going to do about it. And that's the Nirmanakaya. And thirdly, we begin to make a relationship between these two, and that's Sambhogakaya. And then that's like the, you know, in Mingyur Rinpoche's Dying Every Day course, we have the Bardo of Dying, which ends in a gap. And then from that gap, we have the Bardo of Dharmata, which is a dreamlike state. That would be to me like the Dharmakaya to the Sambhogakaya to then the Bardo of Becoming, where we take our next form, where our next form solidifies. So Sambhogakaya is that bridge between not knowing what's going on and having a plan or figuring out what you're doing. So he says, and finally, the fourth kaya, which we don't talk about in the Ornament of Precious Liberation, I think. Finally, we have a total experience of the whole, and that's the svabhavika kaya, the essence kaya. That makes four states of mind that we go through, four stages of mind or mental process. These four processes are related with the four kayas, Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya, and svabhavika kaya. The Dharmakaya nature of our reaction to the world is usually uncertain, bewildered. Strategies are not yet formed. Planning is not completely organized. It is just a sense of basic openness. The mnemonic high aspect is the second stage of this process. At this point, there is some kind of clarity in which we have a basic grasp of the situation generally. And in order to make a link between the uncertainty or openness and the clarity, we need some sambhogakāya, which bridges the gap between the two and joins them together. So the dharmakāya and the nirmanakāya are joined together by means of the sambhogakāya. According to this particular tradition, that is the realistic way of looking at things. Svabhavikakāya is understanding the whole thing, total panoramic experience. When we begin to flash our mind to an object, when we have a grasp of it, when we begin to realize some kind of link between the kayas, that totality is what is known as svabhavikakāya. So again, this is something to study. If you have that book, read it. I'm actually going to type that up and send it out so that everybody has that. But you can look at that. You could look at any experience if you remember and unpack it that way. Yes, Deirdre.
I remember Mingyur Rinpoche saying, senior moment, that's when those happen.
Yeah.
You walk into a room and completely forgot why you walked into that room.
Yes.
You have that gap.
Yes.
And then you see the object or whatever, yeah. And then you tie it together. But yeah.
That's think of it as the Dharmakāya. You have a glimpse of the Dharmakāya.
That's what he said.
That's your Buddha nature manifesting.
Yep.
Okay, thanks for bringing that in. Yes. Yes, senior moment. We could think of it that way. And many of us are seniors. We have a lot of them, perhaps. All right. I'm going to plow ahead. Joanne, did you have something? We only have a couple of minutes left. So.
Real fast. When you type that up, would you put the source down at the bottom?
I will. Yeah, I always put the source.
Thank you.
All right. All right, so we're going to plow ahead to finish this material. Right, so now, what about the activities of a Buddha? Well, we can cover that really quickly, and it's actually a very short chapter in Gampopa. So we're going to look at page 164 in Ringu Tulku. When our mind becomes, let's see, now do I want to read that now? No. All right, well, because of we're running up against lack of time, I'm going to throw out Ringu Tulku for the moment. No disrespect, Ringu Tulku. Yes. Jinzang.
If you don't want to rush through it, I mean, I'd certainly opt for us having one more class, even if it's an hour. You want to finish it?
Yeah, I want to finish it today.
Okay.
Everybody can read the chapter themselves.
Yeah, okay.
Basically, what it comes down to is that Gampopa explains how the Buddha doesn't really do anything in the sense of like have an intentional action. There's no conceptuality. We've learned there's no conceptuality and no duality. The Buddha's not even thinking this person there needs that. But he benefits beings, or she benefits beings continuously through body, speech, and mind without any conceptuality or any duality. And so Gampopa gives like examples that Ringu Tulku says are drawn from like Indian mythology. And the first one is, how does he benefit people non-conceptually through his body? Really, it's just by being Buddha. Just by radiating Buddha-ness. So he gives the example is of Indra, just the sparkling god Indra, and people are so blown away by seeing him. They're so inspired that it benefits them and it sort of sets them on the path to want to be that. So we've all probably experienced that, how the Buddha, you know, benefits us through his body is if you see a Buddha statue, you're blown away, your mind opens, you have a senior moment. right. So then with speech, it's the drum, the beating of the Buddha drum. And this is a part you should read in Ringu Tulku if you haven't already. It's very beautiful. Maybe have a moment to read that if I can find it. It's about how everything beats the Buddha drum. All of our experience beats the Buddha drum. What we call the treasure, okay, Buddha's speech manifests in the same way. This is page 166, the top of the page. The form, emanations, and teachings are present everywhere, like literally everywhere. And this is talked about in the Ocean of Definitive Meaning, the Buddha, I forget how it's like in the context of the guru, like everything becomes your guru. The teachings of the Buddha can be heard in the sounds of nature, in the wind, the rustle of the leaves, or the crashing of the waves. Have we experienced that? Awakening is in all of those. You hear the wind blowing, you hear the waves crashing. I know Kathy and Dave experience this all the time with the ocean at their doorstep. They're present everywhere in the midst of all manifestations, the teachings of the Buddha, which is his, that is his speech. So he doesn't have to do anything. He doesn't have to even teach. His teachings can be heard in every phenomenon that we encounter if we're open to it, if we're awake to it. This is what we call the symbolic guru of the universe, which means that whatever we see and experience can become a source of teachings and enlightenment. It isn't a way of seeing things or a subjective projection. The manifestations of Buddhas and realized beings can take any form, and these forms don't necessarily need to be alive. They could be music, a hospital, a bridge, a boat, food, water, or anything beings may need. So we're not even talking about symbolism here. It is Buddha. Like, it literally is Buddha. Yes, Jinzang.
I was saying, I had a that was a little confusing to me, because this idea that the symbolic guru is, you know, often it's like if you see clouds moving, you think, oh, that is how all phenomena are impermanent and moving and not affecting the sky. And that does imply that there's some sort of way of seeing things or subjective projection. I mean, so that's where I got a little confused here. I mean, in terms of, isn't that part of what the symbolic guru is like understanding that thoughts are like the breeze passing through? I mean,
yeah, I think we don't have time. I think don't have time to delve into that deeply. Okay. I apologize. But
no, that's okay. It's just like a question I have about it. Okay, no problem.
We'll all take that question away with us.
Okay.
But keep reading. Keep reading, keep studying, keep contemplating. All right. So then the other examples, we won't have time to talk about our experience with Ringu Tolka, but we'll do that sometime. Okay, the mind on page 166 also, he gives several examples for the mind. And the first one is rain, how like as clouds. Clouds rain when rain is needed, and they rain without thinking that rain is needed. That's how the Buddha's mind works. The Buddha rains down his blessings, his wisdom, his benefit, without making any distinctions or without any kind of thought process. The other examples are the sun shining. We've all heard that one, the sun shining equally on everybody all the time. And the sun is always shining no matter what is going on, no matter how many clouds there are. That's the Buddha's mind. These are like metaphors, Jinzang. So I don't know if that's helpful. Yeah.
I've answered my own question in the sense that everything having the nature of emptiness and manifestation, in that sense, everything is Buddha. So sorry.
I think that's a good answer, and thanks for sharing that. Thank you.
Can I do one there?
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
There's a concept in Taoism of Wu Wei, which is action and non-action. Mm-hmm. It means that it's action without any ego involvement.
Right.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, that's Buddha.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Buddha. We can't do that until we reach the end of the path, but we can be aware of it happening, and we can become more and more aware. So then I just want to, the last example is the wish fulfilling gem, and it becomes really important when we get to the very end of the book, which we're about to do. So we're going to run 5 minutes over. If anybody needs to leave, then you may. The wish fulfilling gem fulfills all wishes. Like, it doesn't evaluate the wishes. It's like, if you're open to it, if you're there and you're making a wish, then your wish is granted. So the reason that I wanted, so that's it. That's body, speech, and mind benefit beings continuously without any conceptuality. That will be our job when we become Buddha. And that's what we will do. And it's so obviously it takes no effort to do that. That is full awakening. So what I want to look at the very end now is the very end of the book. It's on in Ornament of Precious Liberation. If you don't have the book in front of you, that's fine. But we're just going to polish it off. And the first time I taught this, which was a few years ago, it just hit me like, oh my God, I just hadn't gotten it until that moment. So, and it's because of the examples we just got of how the Buddha benefits beings. So we're on page 295, if you do have the book, the very last two paragraphs. This concludes the ornament of precious liberation, a wish-fulfilling gem of sublime Dharma. So that's what hit me, is he's referring to the book itself as, or precious liberation as, a wish-fulfilling gem. This is the wish-fulfilling gem. The path is the wish-fulfilling gem. The process of waking up is the wish-fulfilling gem. Awakening is the wish-fulfilling gem. So this concludes the ornament of precious liberation, a wish-fulfilling gem of sublime Dharma. Progressively explaining the Mahayana path, composed by the physician Sonam Rinchen, he's using his ordinary old name, that's Gampopa, at the instigation of Dharma Chop, one of his students, and transcribed by the latter. So this student, Dharma Chop, asked him to give these teachings. He obviously gave them over a period of time. He transcribed it, and that's what became the book. And so Gampopa's parting words are, whatever merit there may be in your transcription in terms of non-conceptual benefit for beings through the wish-fulfilling sacred Dharma, the Dharma itself is the wish-fulfilling gem, may it help all beings attain supreme enlightenment virtue. And before we tie things up, I just wanted to point out the last chapter in Ringu Tulku's book, which is the conclusion. And on page 170, he urges us to keep working with this. Like, don't just read the book and walk away. That's not going to do it. He says, first, to truly understand the notions taught and then meditate on them. First, try to truly understand the notions taught, like what's taught here, and meditate. Then meditate on them to deepen your understanding. Apply continuously what you've learned in your daily life. Apply it in your daily life, but don't get rigid or tense about it. Certain people tend to take things too seriously. Don't be that person. Feeling guilty, for example, if they get up late one day for their morning meditation. That's excessive. Your practice shouldn't become a burden, although you should try to maintain a certain regularity. In fact, only this regularity will allow you to stabilize the understanding you have acquired and use it to cope with the situations of your daily life. When you can practice, rejoice, but if for some reason you can't, there's no need to feel guilty or depressed. Don't turn your practice into a source of stress or worry. You haven't been able to do anything for a few days, that's no disaster. Remember the time when you did nothing at all before you encountered the Dharma. To do a little is better than doing nothing at all. Don't take things too seriously. Put them in a more realistic perspective. This last bit of advice ends my commentary on the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, Gampopa's most important work. And here he says, it's not mentioned. Oh, wait a minute. That's not it. He talks about the process of it being done. But he says at the bottom of that page, I'm conscious of not having taught it correctly or as systematically as it should have been taught. In the traditional manner, this text is the subject of a whole year of intensive study. So he gave these, probably was teaching every day for a period of time. And so, I mean, it's a lot of material. It filled up a year for us. We used our weeks right between classes to really study, contemplate, and meditate. So we put in our year, and that's the fruit. So having said that I don't want to meet next week, we didn't really get a chance to chat and wrap things up per se and share our Ringu Tulku observations or experience. So if I'm going to unmute people now, we will do our I'll remute to do our dedication in just a moment. But if you would like to meet next week for an hour, we can do that and just have a chat. And if not, that's fine too. We'll be resuming in December with the new course. Any thoughts on that?
Fine with another. Oops.
Dave, is that a vote for meeting next week?
Yeah.
All right. Well, how about if I'm just here next week? We'll be here next week. Jinzong, you'll be here next week?
Yeah, from 2 to 3, okay.
Okay, well, that'll give us a chance to try out our new format, which will be like an informal discussion format. So whatever thoughts you didn't get to share today, anybody who wants to come, we'll meet next week. I'll be here next week. And then I'll actually be away again for a while. All right. So I'm going to, anybody have any parting words before we do the dedication? Yeah, John, go ahead.
Oh, just that I have a comment for both you and Lama Jinzang if you get after we're finished here.
Okay. You mean you want us to stay on or?
If I could just, yeah, I got something to say about the tech.
Sure. Okay. All right. So we'll do that after the dedication.
And I want to say thank you to both of you for a wonderful course. This has been great.
Yay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm in on that one.
And thank you to Gampopa and Ringu Tulku and everybody in between. All right. And thanks to everybody for being here. I mean, you know, it's like the support of everybody that makes it happen. Everybody's comments and insights and questions are really appreciated. So I'm going to mute everybody again and we'll just do our dedication. All right, again, one more time. Body to the seat, mind to the body, and ease to the mind. Sending out love and compassion to all beings while resting in spacious awareness. Oh, we didn't do the meditation. I had a little meditation. Well, we'll do that. It was a Three Kayas meditation from Ringu Tulku. We'll do that next week. All right. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. All right, so we'll be here again next week, same time, same cyberspace, but a little bit shorter and very informal. So bring your thoughts about Gampopa or any other thoughts you want to share, and we'll see you then.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.